Rebel-held areas of the central Syrian city of Homs continue to come under intense bombardment from the Syrian army this morning. That comes at the same time that the Friends of Syria group, including more than 70 Western and Arab nations, convened in Tunis. Joining us now, John Lee Anderson, staff writer for The New Yorker. He's been reporting from the front lines in Syria. He was in Homs 2 weeks ago, and he joins us now from his home in England. John Lee, first of all, let's talk about this Friends of Syria group. We're getting some hints at what they want, an immediate ceasefire. What do you think this community, this gathering of 70 nations, would be willing to do to help the Syrian people?
Well, there's been rumors for a number of weeks that, there's been an attempt to create, I should say, a dynamic amongst Western nations and allied Arab nations that are opposed to the Assad government to create enough dynamic to support somehow the Syrian opposition, which, as you've described, is very eclectic, very disparate, and not very organized. This is built especially in the last 2 weeks since the renewed veto by Russia, China in the UN Security Council, which sort of galvanized the military push by Assad against Homs and the other cities where there are opponents. And I think the really traumatic events of Homs as the bloodshed increases have brought things to a new tempo, possibly, especially since the killings of the journalists yesterday, in Homs. And I think there's an attempt both to create a kind of political platform, at least a semblance to drum together the semblance of political unity in the Syrian opposition, which is, I think, what most people that would like to see a change in Syria feel is sorely lacking. And I think they're hoping to hammer that out of this, or begin the path to. Meanwhile, we're hearing, and we have been for about 2 weeks, by sort of well-placed Western diplomats, former ministers, including, say, Malcolm Rifkin, former Foreign Secretary, Minister of Defense in Britain, saying that he believed that certain countries may already be providing weapons to the rebels. Now, I think, that's a kind of wink and a nod way of letting it be known that they are. And we assume that that's Qatar and Saudi Arabia, who both Sunni nations have been amongst the most vociferous and vehement against Assad's government. But also there has been pressure on Turkey, which is a frontline state in this and which already has a kind of...
And a diplomatic leader.
Yes, and a diplomatic leader, and a kind of ambiguous stance on exactly how far it's willing to go in terms of its support with the Syrian opposition for a kind of humanitarian corridor or buffer zone along its border.
Yeah. We're speaking with John Lee Anderson, who is a staff writer for The New Yorker, has been reporting for the front lines in Syria, and I wanted to play for you this cut. We got these internet videos yesterday from some reporters who are stranded, injured and stranded in Homs. This is French reporter Yves Bouvier.
My leg is broken, the length of my femur. I need to be operated on as quickly as possible. The doctors have treated me as best as they can, except they cannot perform any surgical operations. So I need as quickly as possible, during a ceasefire, a car with medical equipment, or at least in good condition, to take me to Lebanon to be treated as quickly as possible.
That must be, especially for you, who was just there 2 weeks ago, this place which has become so dangerous for journalists. Hearing that must be, what do you think when you hear Edith begging for help?
Oh, it's heart-wrenching. I mean, I was just back in Lebanon for 3 days for the memorial for one of our dear friends and colleagues who died last week in Syria. And after his memorial on Tuesday, woke up to the news of our other friends killed in Homs. And of course, Edith is a survivor of that attack, which killed Marie Colvin and Remy Oshlik. And they're stuck in Homs under terrible siege. As of yesterday morning, early in the wee hours, in fact, before I returned to England from Beirut, I was meeting with people who were actively involved in trying to get them out. And the problem was the siege has not stopped. The Syrian government has taken the position that they snuck in and are essentially, propagandists for people they regard as terrorists. And, they're playing hardball. And I know that there have been efforts to reach the Russians, who are, of course, the Assad government's principal sponsor, to get them to sort of shame them into getting the Assad government to at least cease fire to allow an ambulance to bring Edith out. I understand from doctors that are working with her that, you know, they're very, very primitive conditions, that she's so badly wounded that they fear that her heart will stop, basically, and that she'll die of loss of blood unless she's moved by really qualified medical personnel. So, thus the video appeal that you broadcast for,
which
us.
Was difficult. It was difficult for me to watch. I can't imagine what it was like for you. But take a listen here. This is Basma Kodmani, who she's with the exiled Syrian opposition, and here's what she had to say about these attacks recently.
The population is desperate to get the media to cover the reality on the ground, so there's no reason to shoot at journalists. It is therefore most probably people related to the regime trying to deter journalists from working in Homs.
What do you think? Do you think that journalists are actually being targeted?
Well, I can't, you know, I mean, one doesn't have the facts, but it's from what I've heard, 11 rockets immediately hit that media center, which was known to be a media center, which was apparently where all reporters, those few who'd gotten in, had stayed. Marie Colvin, the American correspondent for the London Sunday Times, had been on Anderson Cooper the night before her death, speaking on a sat phone, which can be apparently traced. The point is, the next morning, you know, 11 rockets hit that house directly, and they were killed. And so one has to assume, yes, that they were targeted specifically. I mean, I that's my conclusion.
Now, which would be a war crime.
I guess it would be, amongst other war crimes. You know, I was also a few weeks ago when I was I was with another reporter in Syria, and we also visited a rebel-held town, and shortly after the army, with a caution, let us through. They also began shelling the town, and eventually, after 4 or 5 hours of this, it wasn't anything like the siege of Homs, but it was, you know, there were things hitting the houses next door. A person outside was wounded. It seemed intentional. I eventually called the most senior official I knew, who was the foreign ministry spokesman, and told him that I was there. I assumed they already knew.
We're going to get more of your personal recollections of reporting from Syria in just a moment. John Lee Anderson, staff writer at The New Yorker. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
We're back with John Lee Anderson, staff writer at The New Yorker. He's been reporting from all around Syria and, in fact, returns from Homs just 2 weeks ago, and he joins us now from his home in England. We were speaking about how dangerous it is in Syria, and one of the things that we heard was someone mentioning how desperate the people there are for reporters to get in and report. And I wanted to talk to you about the opposition in Syria, which, as you were saying, is very disparate. Is there any chance that these people will group together eventually and form a unified front as they did in, say, Libya or in Egypt?
You know, Syria is a very complex society with multiple ethnic groups and sects, and that's part of the complicating factor, and also the Assad regime. I mean, Gaddafi was also very clever at playing off his enemies against one another and co-opting, particularly there, the tribes. But somehow it was a simpler alchemy, just, you know, than Syria, which also is a kind of body with nerve endings attached to all of the regional powers. You know, Iraq is next door, Israel is next door, Jordan. You know, you have the Russian naval base there. You've got lots of interests angling for Syria. So. It's more difficult, and the regime has been much more violent in its response, and so it's proven much more difficult. Now, I do think that we're reaching a point where it's clear that the regime has signaled that it's going for broke. It's the Grozny option. It is the Hama option. I'm speaking about when this Assad's father put down a rebellion in 1982 in the city of Hama at the cost of 20 to 30,000 people. Nobody knows exactly, but he effectively leveled it, much as they're doing right now with Homs. So, you know, the Syrians know the consequences, and it's it seems that this is their moment to effect the transformation. They have the world's attention. The zeitgeist has changed. So I suspect we will see something hammered out. Hillary Clinton is obviously involved at moving around the region, speaking out on this now. And it seems like that there are plenty of activities going on behind the scenes to create a political unity. Now, that doesn't guarantee that there will be unity on the ground. There's a real problem of communication. You have a political opposition moving sort of between hotel lobbies in Doha and Tunis and Paris, and then you have these defectors, army defectors, who've gone back to their hometowns and counties and are leading kind of home guards in what are, you know, extremely dramatic, tenuous military situations. And the twain haven't quite met up yet, but that's the effort underway to see it happen. I think it's going to be very bloody. That's all I can say at the moment. The one certainty I have is that however this plays out, it's going to be very bloody, as we've seen. This is just beginning.
Let's take a listen then to a comment that U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made.
There will be increasingly capable opposition forces. They will, from somewhere, somehow, find the means to defend themselves as well as begin offensive measures. And the pressure will build on countries like Russia and China, because world opinion is not going to stand idly by.
Help us understand what she's saying there. Somehow or other, the rebels will be armed?
This is an elegant way of saying efforts are underway by our intelligence community in cooperation with allies. This is diplo speak. I mean, she can't say it explicitly. Officially, the United States, much as it was with Libya, although we were more aware of an American, effort behind the scenes to sort of provide the, to load and fuel and even, I believe, arm the aircraft that NATO flew over Libya, Americans were not involved. In the post-Bush years, there's a recognition that the American presence overt in the region's conflicts is an inflammatory ingredient, and clearly under President Obama they have chosen to take a different route. And now, with the Arab Spring, you're beginning to see new forces emerge, with a kind of reemergent Turkey wanting to assume its once a century ago lost leadership role in the region. And countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, for their own reasons, a lot to do with this kind of proxy conflict with Iran, which is, of course, seen as Assad's main backer, wanting to intervene as well and alter the situation on the ground there.
So we're speaking with John Lee Anderson, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker and has been reporting from Syria. And I wanted to play you one more comment here. This is an activist in Homs talking about the situation on the ground.
The people was starving. We start to eat even the plants from the garden. And we are collecting rain in container to drink the rainwaters.
He's talking about pretty serious conditions there. I understand that if it's not a humanitarian crisis yet, it will be soon. Could the government actually succeed at this point? Could they break the spirit of the Syrian people and end this uprising?
If you kill enough people, you can neutralize your opposition. I mean, that's a rule of war that's been played out since the times of King Herod. It works. If you kill people, it works. And if you kill enough, you then traumatize the survivors, and they're putty in your hands, as happened in Syria for 30 years after the slaughter in Hama. I think Bashar al-Assad is hoping that will work in this case. It seems that it's mestizized. I don't think it will work in this case. The people seem to have lost their fear. And when people lose their fear, they also – there's a kind of alchemy that occurs. People also get into a state of mind where they are not afraid to die. And that is that's the fundamental difference
but
here.
But let me ask you, with all the news that we've had with the journalists who've been injured, still waiting to get out, with those who've been killed, would you go back to report from Syria?
Yes, I would. It's an important story. We need to know what's going on.
Knowing that you would be risking your life.
I did before. I would hope not to risk it too much, but I would. I think it's a very important story for all of us.
John Lee Anderson, staff writer at The New Yorker, which is where you can read some of his great reporting coming from Syria. He was in Homs just 2 weeks ago, and he joined us today from his home in England. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Celeste. Thanks a lot.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.